After I encouraged you to investigate chosen states and themes in your life that come up in your meditation practice rather than just treat them as hindrances, I would like to do the opposite today. Tell you something about specifically dealing with thoughts, thoughts you don't want to follow, thoughts you don't want to investigate, thoughts you deem not worthy of your attention, or you deem not fruitful or wholesome. In other words, basically how you can quieten thoughts and how you can distance yourself from thoughts and what you can do with thinking. As you're aware that thought takes a large amount of our inner space. For many people, non-meditating people, probably, they would think that when they speak of their mind, they generally speak of thought. For meditators, this usually changes because they recognize that behind and underneath and in between their thoughts are considerable spaces. And that really interesting things in mind happen before thoughts really become formed and contoured. So there is some very specific advice in the Buddha's teaching what to do with the type of thought that disturbs your meditation. Now, before I go into this, it is obvious that you will need to, at some point, make a decision which things are disturbances and which things are worthy of investigation. And if a disturbance has a certain tenacity and recurrence and just doesn't go away and keeps coming back, retreat after retreat, year after year, then it's probably worthy of investigating. Yeah. So a meditation approach that simply says thoughts you need to disappear, and then I can be a decent human being, and then the good things happen, is, in the long run, not going to work. Yeah. So part of our practice is that we have to put down, let go, allay thoughts, because they disturb meditation indeed. And yet, amongst those thoughts that keep coming back, and that keep turning up, there is some investigation needed. But this is a paradox. Don't blame me for it. It's just how it works. Yeah. So you need to make a decision which things are worthy of investigation and which things are not, amongst the things that are thoughts in your mind. Most of them are not. That's what my experience tells me. So it is important to learn how to still the mind. If you're in doubt about it, try to still it. Try to allay it. Try to put it aside. Or simply, as you've learned from Rakefet Sandhya last night, let go. Yeah. This is a lot more crucial. Not what you get. You know, what are the results of my practice? What do I actually get from sitting here day after day? But, what can I let go of? So the Buddha is very specific and gives us five different techniques dealing with thought. And I'm speaking here of thoughts that are recurrent. And the first one is very simple. It comes with an analogy. And the technique consists of simply not paying attention. This is the most elegant, this is the most direct, and this is the cheapest of the one which costs least energy. Simply there's a thought coming, and I simply don't pay attention. The image is that as if you walk along a street, and then somebody comes, and you simply don't look. Yeah. They just walk past. The Japanese tradition has a very beautiful image. It says, speaks of the blue mountain and the white cloud. You know, the blue mountain, this is the body sitting still. Yeah? And the white cloud is the thought. Yeah? And the blue mountain and the white cloud, they don't quarrel. Yeah? The mountain stays the mountain, the cloud stays the cloud. The mountain stays put, the cloud moves. They're not fighting, they're not flirting. The mountain is the mountain, the cloud is the cloud. So that's the definite first approach to thoughts that disturb you from staying with the breath. You try not to pay attention. That's the easiest, the most elegant, and in many ways the most effective. If that doesn't work, and you recognize the thoughts that you have in mind has something to do with desire. Well, let me preface this. You try, when you recognize the thought has an unwholesome quality to it, you try to take the energy of the thought, you do some judo, you take the energy and you take to gain something wholesome from it. In judo, this is simple. If he pushes, you pull him. If he pulls you, you push him. Yeah. In any way, he gets double. And generally, he loses his balance. There are more subtle ways of doing that, and I'm not doing justice to the martial art of judo right now, but this is a fundamental principle. So if you do your meditative judo, then you try to take the energy of the unwholesome thought and you try to gain some wholesome consideration. So if it is a thought connected with desire or greed, which stimulates your mind, you try to create a perception of what evokes your desire that is different, that is opposite, that makes you more still. Yeah? Traditionally, if it is desire for people, then you would look at something not attractive. You would try to look for something that is not attractive. If you're attracted by the beautiful or the prettiness or the alluring nature of something, you would look a little closer. Sometimes it's just enough to look a little closer. If you ever looked at your face in a mirror with 5 times magnification, your pretty skin suddenly 5 times magnified can look pretty wild. Pretty wild territory. So the tradition speaks of asubha kamatan. It speaks of a practice of making a particular effort to focus on the unpleasant. Because desire is generally the response to something pleasant. You've heard that last night. The problem is not the enjoyment and the pleasantness of things. The problem is that we respond to enjoyment and pleasantness of things with a wish to have more of it, or to prolong it, or to have it again, or to vary it a little bit. It's not the enjoyment that is the pleasure, the problem. It is our attachment to the enjoyment that becomes the problem. If we could just enjoy and let go, we'd be safe, we'd be fine. So the Buddha is not down on enjoyment. He is not down on the fact that we are capable of experiencing pleasure. He is very much down that we try to have it, hold it, grasp it, cling to it, not let go of it. That's what he thinks is the reason for our pain and our suffering. So with the practice around desire, if it is people, then consider what about the people I am feeling attracted to or infatuated with or I feel desire for. What is not pleasant? Maybe, how shoddy their washing up happens, or, how badly they park their shoes in front of the meditation hall. In American and English, you say beauty is skin deep. The things you find attractive generally are not many different things. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. That's the first 5 meditation subject you get as a Buddhist monk, by the way. You don't get emptiness, dependent origination, and profound transcendent wisdom. You get hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. These are your first meditation subjects. Considering the nature of these and you consider something about attractiveness. Now, you know, there's if hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin are all in the right place, they can be quite alluring. But if, say, the hair of the head start looking, if you see them in the sink on the loo, then they are a lot less alluring. So sometimes it's just a matter of shift of perspective. Yeah. Sometimes it's just a matter of actual proximity, you know, that sometimes it takes a little look, closer look, and what seemed attractive, you know, sort of in the counterlight and under a silky blouse or so, looks very attractive, but then you look a little closer and it's not so attractive intrinsically anymore. So much of what pulls our desire is a construction of mind. Yeah. It's a perception, and perceptions live from the fact that we edit out things. Yeah. So desire, attractiveness in terms of people, can often be counteracted by simply redirecting my attention to another aspect. Just a little shift. Yeah. If the attractiveness is in things, then it is a worthy consideration to the amount of energy that goes into that thing. Yeah, what that thing costs, how much energy it takes, how much responsibility it demands of us. Yeah, that's one thing. So we consider the amount of effort we need to put, the amount of energy we need to invest into something that seems attractive. Yeah. You find a car attractive. Yeah. But a car is excellent. It's 1.5 tons of metal, plastic. It costs taxes. It guzzles fuel. You struggle with parking spaces. You spend endless hours in traffic jams. So cars are intrinsically not very attractive. Yeah. Although you can move, they can look quite pretty. You know, you can consider the amount of effort you have to put into working to be able to afford the thing. Another contemplation that helps you with the attractiveness of things is the consideration of its compounded nature. It is compounded of elements. It's made up of elements. That's one of the Buddhist contemplations, discerning elements in our experience. I haven't said anything about this yet, but well, maybe in the days to come. So you consider this is put together by earth, water, fire and air. Corresponding states are expansion, solidity, resistance, that's earth. Fire is calorosity, warmth. Air is vibration, and water is cohesiveness. Yeah. So any aspect of my experience consists of these elements. I can find them in my body, I can find them in the outside world, I can find them in my breath in some ways. So whatever is attractive right now to me and is the focus of my disturbing thought, I can try to consider in terms of the four elements. If the thought is connected with anger, then generally anger is about people. I can connect with the compassion aspect. I can make myself clear that these people who are evoking my anger right now and the thought of which preoccupies me, can I find something in this person that resembles my own humanity? That's the simplest way of connecting with Karuna. By making this being a human being like myself, suddenly, if I have a relationship to my own pain and suffering and I have a relationship to this other person as a human being, then this being also suffers. Is also prone to pain, is prone to frustration, to fears. And considering that helps me bring this human being into a space where he is a human being like myself. I can no longer completely reject him, push him out of my heart. Yeah. So the direct way of dealing with thoughts about anger is compassion. The commentaries recommend us that the way to practice with anger is metta. This is true, but it's only half true. Metta practice is very successful in dealing with the tendency to anger in our mind when we are not angry. It's not an intervention technique. Yeah? Metta practice is not very effective when we are already angry. Yeah? We can try to convince us that we're not actually quite loving, but underneath is anger. It's like, you know, you have 600 cows here in kibbutz, and or I don't know, you know what a cow pad is? You know, it's what cows leave behind after eating. Yeah, it's kind of lying on the ground. Now you can cover that with sugar. Yeah, and it looks kind of sugary on the surface, but underneath it's not sugary. Underneath it's cow shit. Yeah. So if you try to do metta practice when you're angry, this is a similar principle. You know? It may have a sugar coating, but underneath it remains cow shit. So it doesn't transform very well. You know? So, but what metta does, if we are not angry, it makes the mind less receptive for anger to actually take root. Yeah? So metta, when the mind is not angry, is a prophylacticum, yeah? It's a prophylactic medicine. It helps. It's the preventive? Yeah, probably, yeah. Preventive medicine, yeah? Not interventive medicine. So when anger is already here, use karuna, considerations around compassion. When you want to practice with anger while you are not, then practice metta. This makes the heart more resilient against anger to take root. So, this is the second method. You take something that is unwholesome, say like desire or anger, and then you look for something inside that that becomes more real, that becomes more true, that doesn't evoke desire. Yeah. For desire with people, you look for something that is not pretty, that is not beautiful, that is not attractive. For desire for things, when you find desire for things, you look at how much effort, how much work, how much maintenance, how much sweat something would cost you. The third method, it's interesting, the third method consists of acknowledging when you have a thought that you feel comes back and that triggers an unwholesome emotion in your mind, that you tell yourself, oh, let me give you the image for the second method. The image for the second method is, if you have a thorn in your finger, you take something similar to the thorn, namely a needle or a pin, and you fish out the thorn, yeah? So something sharp and hard that is in your flesh, and you take something very, very similar, like a needle, and you can fish it out. Yeah? So with one thought that is unwholesome, one thought that is unwholesome is being removed with another thought that may be more wholesome. Yeah? Or the other image that is used is like a carpenter uses to get out a big wedge. Again, we have this word that doesn't seem to be existing in Hebrew. And you take... Trees.
Most people don't use it.
It's what carpenters use, yeah? So you have a big one, and you take the big one out with a small one. Yeah. Maybe the image with the needle and the thorn is more clear. So the problem and the solution are quite similar, yeah? The third method consists in, the image is also very stark. It says that there is a young man or a young woman and they want to go to a festival and they want to look pretty. And to look pretty, they want to adorn themselves. So they use something to look pretty. And instead of adorning themselves, they take a dead animal and hang it around their neck. Yeah. So... Yeah, a dead dog or something like a dead cat. Yeah. And the effect is grotesquely opposite, isn't it? You want to look pretty, you want to adorn yourself, and you do something that has the contrary effect. People are repelled and think, why do you put this stinking cat around your neck? Yeah. So the third method to deal with unwholesome thoughts that you recognize as unwholesome, that's the clinch, it consists of calling to mind that you know this thought is against your better knowledge, this thought is against your principles, it is against your value, and it's against your intentions. Yeah. So if you know, if I keep thinking of her, then I really get angry. So whenever I keep thinking of her, I say, well, do I want to get angry? No, I'm here to be quiet. I'm here to be still. I'm here to be loving. But whenever I think of her, for any length of time, I get angry. So I'm not going to follow this thought, because following this thought takes me to the contrary place to what I want. In other words, it appeals to my better knowledge. It appeals to my better self, if you want. Yeah. I'm not here to cultivate anger, frustration, and wasting my time thinking about her. So I'm here to actually free my heart. And I'm not going to follow this angry thought about her. Maybe if I have a nice thought about her, I consider. Yeah. If it's too nice, I'm not going to follow it either. So I appeal to myself. I appeal to that part in me which knows. I appeal to that part in me which has ethical sensibility and has experience. To please don't give me that thought. Because if I follow that thought, I will be like the young man or the young woman who wants to please everybody and then who has a dead animal around his or her neck. Yeah. Method four is interesting. Method four has an analogy, and it says, there is a man running, and then he thinks, oh, I am running. How come I could run? Could I run more slowly? And then he runs more slowly. And running more slowly, he thinks, well, I'm still running. Yeah. Could I maybe walk? Yeah. And then he decides, oh, yes, I can walk. And then he starts walking. And he says, well, I'm walking. Could I walk more slowly? He does so. Could I stand still? And then he finds out he can stand still. So this is the analogy. And the technique consists on basically becoming conscious of what we're doing and becoming conscious of that we are doing it. Yeah. That is us doing it. Yeah. When we are conscious of us doing it, we suddenly become aware that if we are doing it, we probably can also not do it. Yeah. In other words, we have what here in the recitation we do every morning, we do kamasaka. Yeah. We become responsible for ourselves. Yeah. We are owners of our own action, and we are capable of being the responsible stewards of these actions. So by stop pretending that somebody else is doing my thinking, somebody else is to be blamed for the movies I have in my head, somebody else is to be blamed for my emotions, I admit that basically I'm doing this. I do the emoting, I do the thinking, I do the reacting, I do the fantasizing, I do the dreaming, I do the memorizing. It's this being here who is responsible for this. So by acknowledging this, I can gain a little power. Yeah. Maybe I can think that thought more slowly. Yeah. This is an interesting one. Kind of, can you slow down your thoughts? Yeah. I don't know, some of you were probably old enough to remember when we had record players, yeah, which had different speeds. Some of you are too young, so just don't bear with us. Yeah. But there was a time you had singles and they were running on 45 RPM. Yeah? And you have long players on 33. And you could play the singles on 33 and it would do very strange things. It would make your tune a lot longer, but it would distort it. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you can do that with some MP3 players by now. You can just kind of turn the speed and it goes slow. So one funny way of taking the credibility out of a thought is by changing its speed. Yeah. Or you can think, can I think that thought with a very low voice? Yeah. Yeah. And suddenly your thought becomes less attractive, or it becomes less haunting, or it becomes less compulsive, yeah? You gain a little bit of control over your thought. So you can play, or you can make it very, very high, yeah? So you can, or you can exaggerate, yeah? The thought is a little bit grumpy, a little bit unhappy, and you say, right now, okay. No more bother this morning on the table. Life can't continue that way. This is the end, yeah? You exaggerate the little bit of mood, you know. You kind of make a grotesque of it. So most thoughts don't like that. Most thoughts lose their seriousness. You know, when you start playing with your thought, they lose their seriousness and their power over you. Yeah. So as soon as they lose their power over you, they're less of a danger. Yeah. So by this technique, you you try to gain a little bit of control. You become conscious that the thinking has something to do with what you are doing. And if you are doing it, then you have some power in doing it differently. Maybe you can't stop it right now, but you can do it a little differently. When you can do it a little differently, you know, you can do it a little more differently. Yeah. And when you can do that, you can gradually change it. You can become more quiet. You can suddenly become smiling at yourself over, you know, the intense serious ferocity of a thought, which you realize is just, you know, it's kind of, it's the voice of a 4-year-old if you listen closely, yeah. So one of the things that helps me is listening to the voice of these thoughts, because sometimes, you know, they kind of, they drum on their chest and they say, I'm important, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you realize, actually, it tries to sound like a, you know, silverback gorilla, but actually it's a 4-year-old boy in there. Yeah. And when you listen to that voice, suddenly you can't believe it anymore. Yeah. You can't take it serious anymore. It loses its grip over you. So technique number 4 asks you to become aware of the power you have in the thinking of that thought. And when you acknowledge that power, you will become capable of influencing the thought. And sometimes you can do little funny things with it, and it loses its, you know, it loses its seriousness, it loses its credibility, it loses its worth, yeah. And then if it is very hollow, it can just, you can just kind of put it aside. I don't know, maybe you've never done that as kids, but I used to repeat words till they had lost all meaning, yeah, as a kid. I remember kind of chewing words, and then kind of, and after a while you repeated a word so much that it had lost all meaning, that it was just pure sound. Yeah. You kind of, you felt your mouth moving with the word, and the word had lost all meaning. So this is a little bit what happens with technique number 4. You take the meaning, the seriousness, you know, the appeal out of the thought. Technique number 5 is definitely the last technique. The image is, I think, pretty stark. It says, it is as if a man would take another man, take him by the shoulders and press him with his shoulders onto the ground and hold him there. And technique, to give you the literal translation, it says, a meditator is sitting with teeth clenched, with tongue pressed against the palate, and he overcomes mind with mind. Yeah. So, in other words, it is suppression. Yeah, we suppress a thought. That is pretty. It takes a lot of energy. It is unpleasant. It has psychological consequences if we do this. At the same time, it is indispensable. Every civilization hinges, in fact, on our willingness to suppress impulses. Yeah. If you have the impulse to hit your neighbor, I'm very grateful if you suppress that impulse at all cost. Yeah. Our common sense of safety here depends on your willingness and ability to suppress such impulses. Yeah. So The act of suppression is a conscious act that is very important to distinguish this act from another act called repression, which is not a conscious act of suppression. Now, if you suppress a thought, then you suppress it, you don't allow it to grow, you don't allow it to become the basis of an activity, either of speech or action, or even mental focusing of your energies, and you place a little flag, you know, where you have buried it. When things are more quiet, you go back and look what's buried underneath the flag. Right now it's too hot, so you need to bury it. But you place a flag. Yeah. At the end of the day, you have a couple of flags standing around, which you know something is buried there which needs investigating. And when you have more calm, more quiet, when there is less pressure, you go and investigate what's underneath the flag. Repression is doing the suppressing bit without the flag. Yeah, it's saying nothing has happened, everything is hunky-dory, no problem here. Yeah, all under control. This is a difference, a very big difference. Yeah. A gentleman named Sigismund Freud has told us more about the more details of how this works and about this distinction, and it's a very precious insight, not very old. Buddhist practice has more awareness of this for a longer time, so I'd like you to be clear. Although there is a need to suppress times, impulses and thoughts in our mind, if they're too destructive, there is a necessity at the later stage to investigate what we have suppressed. To just pretend it has not happened or it's not there does not resolve the problem. That's a very crucial distinction. So, five techniques. First techniques is by far the most preferable one. You know, something comes and you just don't pay attention and it passes you. Like you close your eyes when somebody walks past you. Yeah. Second technique, you try to take the energy of the thought when it is unwholesome and you try to gain a wholesome direction. So, if it is attraction with human beings, you go for considering something unattractive. If it is aversion for human beings, you consider something that makes them more dear, more close, that makes them resemble you more. If it's just attraction to things, you consider the amount of effort it takes to obtain, maintain, and defend these things. If it is just casual thinking with no big profundity, you make yourself clear how precious this time is, how urgent your spiritual needs are, how short your life is. And you make yourself clear that time and attention are finite. You don't have all the time and you don't have all the attention. Some things are more important than other things. And if they are not top of your priority list, you will be disappointed. You will give birth to the baby yesterday, the baby of father avijja and mother desire, the baby which is called dukkha. Yeah. So, some of our thoughts are not particularly greedy and not particularly angry. They're just kind of babbling, yeah, chattering thoughts, and those you need to cut through. Simply cut through. Don't do any profound practices, just cut through them and say, this is too precious of my time to take up, to be taken up by these kind of thoughts. Technique three appeals to our better knowledge, to my better knowledge of what is happening when I give in to that thought. I am here to become more transparent, more clear, more still, more awake, more mindful, more loving. And if I go to that thought, I will end up in a bad place. And I don't want to do this. I don't want to follow. I don't want to join that bandwagon. The image, remember, is the dead animal around the neck. I want to be pretty, and instead of making myself pretty, I put a dead animal around my neck. Technique number four is probably the most subtle one, insofar it takes ownership of the activity. It stops giving the responsibility for what's happening here in this mind and heart outside somewhere. It says, if I'm doing this, I may also be able to not do this. Can I at least do it more slowly? Can I play with it so that it becomes more serious or more believable? And ultimately, can I stop it? Yeah. Can I put it to non-becoming, as one way of the scriptures put it? Take something to non-becoming. Yeah? It's a very gentle way of saying, bring something to its natural end. Technique number 5 consists of suppression. You have decided that this is too dangerous, too destructive. You simply suppress it, marking the place where you suppressed it as a place you will at some point go back to and understand more deeply where that impulse got its energy from. Yeah? Good. Continue your main exercises of breathing, connecting with the sensations of breath, particularly feeling the spaciousness, the space element in the sensation. There is a type of awareness that is object-centered, and there is a type of awareness that is field awareness. Yeah? So the object-centered awareness is more practical and applicable for following the changes of an individual event in your mind. The field awareness quality is more useful if you actually want to have a spatial quality, if you want to feel a whole body or a whole leg, or if you want to feel the inner space. So for citta and upasana practice, often the field awareness is more useful. You kind of sink with your awareness into the organism and you get a feeling, does this welcome me when I go down into that felt realm of my experience? Is this pleasant in there? Is it spacious? Is it kind? Is it constricted? Is it collected? Is it greedy? Is it unhappy? Yeah. Often the field awareness, the widening of our field of awareness, gives us a better access to citta and upasana, gives us a better access to the space of the mind, the climate of the mind. If any of this is too confusing, go back to the breath, go back to the sensation, go back to the posture. You can do that any time. And I would expect that you shuttle between breathing awareness and more expansive awareness of the space of your inner experience. Yeah. If that space is peaceful, let it become more and more and more still. Let the breath carry you to deeper and deeper stillness. If it is not peaceful, then you find out whether this is a local unpeacefulness, then you may just disregard it, or if it is something you may need to actually investigate. Then you don't do the 5 techniques I just spoke about. You do something of the stuff I did yesterday, namely. You're asking gentle questions, and you're trying to establish a respectful relationship to this. Good. Enough of myself for this morning. Let us practice for 15 minutes.